Studio 360.
I'm Hari Kundabolu, guest hosting for Kurt Anderson. I grew up in New York City, and when I wasn't watching garbage romance films, I was listening to a lot of music. And of course, hip-hop in New York in the 90s was pretty unavoidable. I mean, I remember me and my friends blasting Craig Mack's Flavor in Your Ear remix in the summer of 95. We're talking Busta Rhymes, Biggie, L. Cool J was on that. I mean, it was packed. And that's a key part of my childhood. It's unavoidable. But hip-hop would have been easy to miss for Korean-Canadian Sophia Chang. She grew up in the 70s and early 80s before hip-hop had really exploded. And she was far from the rap epicenter. I mean, she was kind of far from everything. She was in Vancouver, British Columbia.
Never mind not hearing hip-hop, I didn't grow up with R&B. It was really like rock and roll, and the closest that I got to hip-hop was punk. That kind of sense of urgency, but not with the beat. But what really changed my life, the song that changed my life, was The Message by Grandmaster Flash and the Furious Five. I heard it in my senior year of high school. Hearing that song and hearing those opening synth notes, and the beat and the bottom, and that's visceral. And then to hear the lyrics, broken glass everywhere, that's wow.
Broken glass everywhere, people pissing on the stage, you know they just don't care. I can't take the smell, can't take the noise, got no money to move out, I guess I got no choice.
I mean, just this world that was painted that was so diametrically opposed to what I had grown up in, it was cinematic.
Don't push me, cause I'm close to the edge. I'm trying not to lose my head. It's like a jungle sometimes. It makes me wonder how I keep from going under.
There was a sense of anger and urgency that said, this is our world. This is our reality. This is who we are, and this is what we're dealing with.
Sophia Chang wanted to be closer to where the music was coming from. So right after she graduated with her degree in French literature, she moved to New York.
At that time, the scene was tiny. You know, it was 1987, and this is right kind of what we all generally call the golden era of hip-hop.
Right.
But it was still very New York-centric. It was birthed here, obviously. So going to the clubs, what was extraordinary about that time was the sense that the whole community was there. So you had the MCs, the DJs, the B-boys, you know, the graffiti artists, but you also had the managers, the A&R people, the promo people, the agents, the lawyers, and hip-hop was the galvanizing force.
Soon after she got to New York, she landed a job with a record label, and she rose quickly to work in A&R and marketing and management for some seminal hip-hop and R&B artists, A Tribe Called Quest, Hieroglyphics, Foo Schnickens, Raphael Sadiq, D'Angelo, and most importantly...
Yeah, I grew up on the crime side, the New York Times side. Staying alive was no job, had second hands. Moms bounced on old men, so then we moved to Shaolin land.
She entered the inner chamber of the Wu-Tang Clan. Led by the brilliant producer RZA, the legendary nine-member group out of Staten Island changed hip-hop forever, starting with their 1993 debut album, Enter the Wu-Tang. And Sophia Chang was right there with him. She's managed RZA as well as other Wu-Tang members like Ol' Dirty Bastard and GZA. And she talks about that lifelong friendship with the Wu-Tang Clan in her new memoir, The Baddest Bitch in the Room. It's an audio memoir released by Audible, so there's no physical book. It traces her incredible career to when she started working in the music industry. I find it fast because you were doing A&R. Was it with Jive?
Yes.
And you worked with A Tribe Called Quest.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it interesting because you're talking about this time where you have all these music executives, and it's like the art and the commerce were together.
Yeah, that's a good point.
But at the same time, I was thinking about that Tribe lyric.
Industry rule industry number 4080, record company people are
shady.
Industry rule number 4080, record company people are shady. So kids, watch your back, because I think they smoke crack. I don't doubt it. Look at how they act.
You know, how are you able to not be one of the shady record executive people that Q-Tip talks about?
I hope he wasn't talking about me. I think that what was always at the core of my MO was I always wanted what was in the best interest of the artists. And I think that I've learned that they don't necessarily get that a lot.
Yeah.
Sadly.
What does... And this is a very basic question, but what exactly does an A&R rep do?
So A&R stands for artist and repertoire. But essentially, the simplest way to describe it is that the A&R person is the talent scout. So they are the person that goes out and they find the talent. But once you find the talent and you convince your label to allow you to sign them, then you shepherd them through the system of the label and the process of making an album, and you facilitate that.
Early 90s, you know, you're obviously one of a few Asians in record industry, and particularly in hip-hop.
Well, I wasn't only an Asian. I was an Asian woman, right? So I was a minority within a minority within a minority. I'm a Korean-Canadian woman. I'm a French lit major. I'm from Vancouver. I mean, my phenotype, my background, my culture, my language, all, none of those things are essentially hip-hop. So to be... Not only to be welcomed, but to be embraced the way that I was so incredible. It was such a privilege to be there. And all of that went to a whole other level with the Klan.
When did you first hear the Wu-Tang Clan?
I first heard the Wu-Tang Clan probably in the spring of 1993 when I got the demo, and it was on a Maxell tape, and I just remember it was like scrawled in kind of crappy handwriting, and at the bottom of it the name was Prince Rakim, and it had his phone number, which I remember to this day.
That's right. RZA's original rap name is Prince Rakim.
It was Prince Rakim. I call him Rakim to this day.
Really?
I do.
Yo, chill with the feedback block. We don't need that. It's 10 o'clock. Hope we the f*** to see that. Feeling mad hostile. Ran out.
And so I heard the demo, and I was playing it for anybody that would listen.
Yeah.
Slap it in my little yellow Walkman. Listen to this, listen to this.
Yeah.
Put on those little shitty
Listen.
So I knew that I wanted to get to know the guys and also the mind behind the music.
Right.
And luckily, the guys were doing some of the recording at Battery Studios, which was in the same building as Jive, and that's when I met all of them.
And then how did you build a relationship when you weren't, like, they weren't on Jive, you weren't representing them at the time, right? You ended up later managing RZA, JZA, and ODB. Mm-hmm. But at the time, that was not your relationship. So how did you become friends? How did you find a way in?
Exactly what you're saying.
Right.
I don't work for you. You don't work for me. You're not signed to my label. You're not signed to my publishing company. I don't manage you. There's no transaction. Right? I'm not sleeping with any of you. There's no money. There's no power. There's no access. There's none of that. I am this woman that is a huge fan who just shows up at your door, and I'm this kind of anomaly, like this little Asian woman, and she's just brimming with excitement, and she's like a Jack Russell Terrier. and we kind of can't get rid of her, but we kind of don't want to.
I want to play a clip from near the beginning of your audio memoir that's on Audible.
What I love about hip-hop, and Wu-Tang in particular, was that they made it acceptable not only to be angry, but also to express that rage through art. As a petite Asian woman, I never had the luxury to simply lean in. I had to kick down the motherfucking door. I had to learn to be big and strong in other ways. As the RZA would say, my tongue is my sword, and I assure you, I have eviscerated many in my day.
You talk about how you appreciated the anger and the rage that Wu-Tang showed in their music, and how rare that was.
Mm-hmm.
Why did that attract you to their music? Why is rage and anger in music and in art specifically important to you?
When I was young, I mean, I got called chink, Jap, gook all the time. Chinese, Japanese, dirty knees, look at these. And that fucking pissed me off.
Yeah.
Watching my parents, and I'm sure you went through this experience, watching my parents who spoke English and still do with an accent and have a clearly different phenotype, right? Who are clearly other. Watching them be made to feel other in the most crass and vulgar way was enraging to me. So to hear music by these black men who also had a sense of rage, who also lived on the margins, who were also held down, and black women, of course, and who were also held down by white supremacy and white patriarchy. I mean, obviously, I didn't have this language when I was a kid, but I knew that I was mad, all right? I just knew that I was mad at being called a chink. And so when I heard this music and feeling this sense of urgency, but also a sense of pride. And one of the things that I find so remarkable about Wu-Tang, yes, we can talk about their rhymes. Yes, we can talk about RZA's beats. What resonated with me as a petite Korean-Canadian woman was also a fearlessness, right? They walked with so much confidence. They would walk through the clubs, a hand on each other's shoulders, so they would form a chain. It was almost the idea of a Spartan phalanx.
Right.
Meaning Wu-Tang Clan ain't nothing to fuck with.
Right.
And that kind of claiming of their space was incredibly powerful.
I was going to say conga line, but you're right. I think a chain is probably a better...
And if you want beef, then bring the ruckus. Wu-Tang Clan ain't nothing to fuck with. Straight from the motherfucking song that's busted. Wu-Tang Clan ain't nothing to fuck with.
I remember when they came out, you could tell there was a degree of fear from part of the mainstream because they were willing to be angry and they were willing to be honest.
Right.
And I think that honesty and that anger and that straightforwardness, and there was nine of them, there was nine black men sharing their truth aggressively.
Yes.
That scared a lot of people. And I look at them now and it's kind of amazing because they love kung fu movies. In a weird way, the Wu-Tang Clan, they kind of made their own kung fu fan fiction. It's the most bizarre thing. Like, they refer to Staten Island as Shaolin.
Straight from the slums of Shaolin. Wu-Tang killer bees on a swarm. You sure have just been took through the 36 chambers of death, kid.
I mean, like, they would almost be seen as nerdy in some ways by today's
standards. No question.
No question. So many of us who don't fit into that white-black binary end up having to navigate that space and be either closer to whiteness or closer to blackness or shift depending on this, you know, code switch depending on the situation.
Sure.
A lot of us have drawn strength from black art and culture.
Yes.
The idea of like speaking truth and
yes.
challenging
yes.
authority. And it's interesting because the Wu-Tang, they actually drew strength from an element of Asian culture.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think that RZA is, I believe that he is the Bruce Lee of hip-hop.
Hmm.
RZA is a philosopher at heart. And think about what Bruce Lee did, right? So he took from all of these traditions, and then he put it together, and he made his own style called Jeet Kune Do. And I think that RZA did the same thing with music. He took all of these styles, and then he created this music. None of us had ever heard anything like it.
Yeah.
Wait a second. It's messy, and it's dirty, and it's grimy, and it's incredible, and it is so vibrant. And I think that he would attribute that to a lot of what he gleaned from watching those martial arts movies.
Shaolin shadow boxing. And the Wu-Tang sword style. If what you say is true, the Shaolin and the Wu-Tang could be dangerous. Do you think your Wu-Tang sword can defeat me?
On guard. I'll let you try my Wu-Tang style.
Is there an argument to be made that it's cultural appropriation?
Cultural appropriation, when it's by people of color, does not feel the same to me. Hmm. I have a very smart friend named Kevin Brynell. He teaches race at Babson College. He says, you know, there are three kind of markers for cultural appropriation. Denigration, exploitation, and erasure. I don't think you could say that Wu-Tang is even remotely guilty of any of those things. It's like you said, they're called Wu-Tang Clan for Christ's
sake. Right, right, right.
Right? Shaolin, you know, my ex is a Shaolin monk to this day, is one of the RZA's closest friends. RZA trained in Kung Fu, right? So rather than erasing Chinese culture, Asian culture, martial arts culture, I think they did the exact opposite. I don't think we would have had Crouching Tiger without the RZA. And I mean that seriously.
Hmm.
I don't think we would have had Rush Hour without the RZA. I'm not saying that Ang Lee and that Chow Yun,
sure.
Of course they all existed. Oh, and they were big stars.
But the films that they were in love with, they were from another era.
Mm-hmm.
So what you're saying is that they kind of brought them back into mainstream relevance.
I think that's right. I think that what happened, Harry, was when people listened, me, for instance, I wasn't interested in kung fu movies because of my cultural denial, right? I wasn't interested in kung fu movies until I met Wu-Tang. Experiencing their love of and respect for Asian culture up close that I had never had myself and frankly had never seen in anybody else, including my people, was phenomenally empowering. Being able to broach the topic of my cultural pride through this circuitous route of hip-hop and Wu-Tang, that's a gift.
Yeah. I started doing stand-up comedy after I saw Margaret Cho do stand-up comedy.
I have a Korean name. My Korean name is Moran, which is a pretty name, but you have to understand I've heard my mother scream it from across the hills. Moran!
I'd never seen a voice that wasn't black, white, or Latino doing stand-up. And even though she was a Korean-American woman from San Francisco, the ability for her to speak about her parents and her life and for her stories to be valid and for her to make people laugh with who she was.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't laughing at her. They were laughing with her. That changed my life. And my only wish was that I knew you existed when I was 14.
Thank you. It would have been
wonderful to know that this music that me and my friends listened to, that was our soundtrack in New York City, that there was an Asian person that was contributing to the movement and we had a place. So I thank you so much.
I am so honored to be here. I really, really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you. Sophia Chang's Audible original memoir, The Baddest Bitch in the Room, is available September 26th.